Sadly, there's stresses that the nation's spirit remains unbroken and continues making progress. Our top story for this half hour, these 17 more people have lost their lives as Israel intensifies its aerial attacks on Gaza despite a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the besieged territory. In the latest attack, the regime's warplanes targeted a house in an area north of Rafah, killing the entire family, most of whom were women and children. Israeli airstrikes also hit Beit Lahia in the north and the areas around the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Over the past 24 hours, at least 124 people have been killed in Israel's indiscriminate bombing campaign. The Israeli forces have also kept attacking the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, leaving a trail of death and destruction there. Areas around Amal Hospital and Khan Yunis were shelled as well. Since the beginning of the Israeli war on Gaza, more than 32,300 Palestinians have been killed, mostly women and children. We're now joined by our correspondent, Moti Abu Musab, who's joining us from Deir al-Bala in central Gaza to bring us up to speed from all the latest as a result of the continuing Israeli genocidal onslaught on Gaza. Moti, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, actually, the Israeli genocide is still persistent against several areas of Gaza Strip, with more airstrikes and more attacks against the Palestinian residential areas in the enclave, in the besieged enclave. Let's begin from Rafah City, whereas an appalling Israeli massacre was committed over the last night after the Israeli warplanes destroyed several residential buildings in the northern part of the city. At least 15 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, were reportedly killed and massacred, while dozens are still trapped and missing under the rubble. In the meantime, when it comes to Khan Yunis city, the Israeli aggression against the Nasser Medical Complex and the Al-Amal Hospital is still continuous so far, with more attacks that are targeting the surrounding areas of those hospitals. According to multiple eyewitnesses, that the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped and abducted dozens of the Palestinian evacuees who are taking shelter in the medical and the Nasser Medical Complex, and they enforced the women and the children to evacuate into the Al-Mawasi area, which, as you know, claimed by the Israeli occupation forces as a safe area despite the frequent and the repetitive Israeli attacks that reached and targeted that area. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes also renewed their airstrikes and attacks against multiple areas of the central area of Gaza Strip. Deir al-Balah City, Al-Maghazi refugee camp, and even Al-Zahra town were hit relentlessly by the Israeli successive belts of fire. Multiple Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed and pummeled by those airstrikes, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. When it comes to Gaza City, as you know, the brutal Israeli aggression is still underway against the Ashifa Medical Complex and the surrounding areas of the Ashifa Medical Complex. More swinging bombardments reached the area and targeted that area, inflicting more destruction in the residential buildings of the Palestinian residents living there. And needless to mention how catastrophic the situation is for the Palestinian evacuees who are still besieged and surrounded inside the buildings of the Ashifa Medical Complex. We are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian civilians who are still besieged in those buildings. They are demanded by the Israeli occupation forces to surrender for the Israeli soldiers, for the Israeli occupation forces. And as you know, that according to what they have experienced over the last couple of days, whoever surrenders for the Israeli occupation forces, he will be killed by those occupation forces. At least 140 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed. The vast majority of them were executed in the field, in the yards of the Al-Aqsa of the Shifa Medical Complex, while hundreds, at least 800 Palestinian civilians were reportedly kidnapped in the medical complex. The Israeli crime is still continuous so far. Even the surrounding areas of the medical complex are under the heavy bombardments and attacks every moment the Israeli occupation forces launch more attacks, more artillery shelling, and even the tanks resumed their attacks against those areas. When it comes to the humanitarian conditions, the Israeli occupation forces once again opened the gunfire and targeted the Palestinian civilians who were gathering near Al-Kuwait roundabout, waiting for the humanitarian aid to reach Gaza City. The Israeli occupation forces didn't hesitate to attack them once again. Dozens of the Palestinian casualties were reportedly, civilians were reportedly injured over those attacks. In the meantime, according to Gaza's health ministry, at least 7 Palestinian civilians were reportedly died of a drowning after they were attempting to obtain those airdrop, the humanitarian aid that filled down in the sea. It presents another evidence that this is insufficient way for those humanitarian aid to be delivered for the Palestinian people in Gaza City and in the northern part of Gaza Strip. While when it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, Beit Hanun City and Beit Lahia City, they were under heavy bombardments after the Israeli warplanes renewed their belt of fire against those areas amid heavy shelling of the Israeli artillery that reached those areas over the last night. So entirely we are talking about continuous and ceaseless Israeli airstrikes and artillery shelling that is still hitting all areas of Gaza Strip amid catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still befalling the people inside Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip.
Moti, one quick question before we leave you. We know that the United Nations Security Council has adopted a resolution for an immediate ceasefire during the holy month of Ramadan in Gaza. How do Palestinians in Gaza feel about that development?
Yes, as you know, that the people here are completely devastated as a result of the continuous and the ceaseless Israeli airstrikes that have been hitting them for roughly 6 consecutive months. So this means that they are impatiently waiting for any ceasefire that guarantees their return to the northern part of Gaza Strip and Gaza City and to stop this bloodshed of them. However, this means actually that any resolution that doesn't guarantee the Palestinian people to return to their northern part of Gaza Strip and Gaza City and obliges the Israeli occupation forces to stop these atrocities against the Palestinian people is absurd and meaningless because all in all, the Israeli occupation forces will resume and continue their attacks against the Palestinian people once this resolution or the time of this resolution over. So the only thing that the Palestinian people actually are demanding these moments is to have a real, permanent and lasting ceasefire that obliges the Israeli occupation forces to stop these atrocities and to guarantee the smooth flow of the humanitarian aid to those areas, particularly Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot. Moti Abu Musabe joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Elsewhere, the United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254 please raise their hand? The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728.
The draft resolution was jointly submitted by the current 10 non-permanent members of the Council. 14 countries, including 4 permanent members of the UN body, voted in favor of the resolution, except the United States that abstained from voting. The actual draft demanded an immediate ceasefire in the holy month of Ramadan, leading to a permanent, sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. But the Russian representative in a statement before the vote said, that the word permanent was omitted before the meeting. Over the past 5 months since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza, Washington has vetoed 3 draft resolutions on the Gaza ceasefire, sparking condemnations at home and abroad. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has welcomed the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In a statement, Hamas stressed the need for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza that leads to the withdrawal of all Israeli forces from the territory and the return of displaced Gazans to their homes. The resistance movement also expressed readiness for a deal securing the release of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails in exchange for Israeli captives held in Gaza. It also called for the delivery of all humanitarian supplies needed in the besieged strip. Hamas further urged the UN Security Council to pressure the Israeli regime to observe the ceasefire in Gaza and stop the genocide of Palestinians. Palestinian ambassador to the UN Riyad Mansour has hailed a Security Council resolution on the Gaza ceasefire, expressing hope that the move will put an end to Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people.
This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed. A nation is being displaced for decades now, but never at this scale since the Nakba. Never this openly, from Tantura to Gaza, from 1948 to 2024. Mr. President, now that this council has finally called for a ceasefire, all forces should coalesce to make sure it is enforced. Apologies to those who the world has failed, to those that could have been saved and were not. Save the lives of those who survived against all odds. Tell them help is on the way. Hold accountable those who inflicted such suffering upon them. End this injustice. End it now. All of this is long overdue. And I thank you very much, Mr. President.
Well, Iran has welcomed the adoption of Gaza's immediate ceasefire resolution by the UN Security Council as a positive, though inadequate, step. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said what is more important than passing the resolution is taking effective measures to enforce it and end Israel's attacks on Gaza and the occupied West Bank. He added that lifting Israel's siege of Gaza, sending extensive humanitarian aid and international funding of Gaza reconstruction are other important steps that must be taken. Kanani said Israel's reaction to the resolution shows how angry it is about the irreparable defeat that the regime has suffered in political and international arenas. He said the Security Council must hold Israel accountable for the crimes it has committed against Palestinians during the past 6 months. 6 months into the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the regime's forces continue to pound homes, refugee camps, and aid convoys, resulting in the death of more civilians in the besieged Palestinian strip.
We came running and found the houses, as you see, destroyed and flattened, and we began the process of bringing out the wounded, survivors, and martyrs. Unfortunately, there is no safe place in the Gaza Strip. There are houses of displaced people and civilians who have nothing to do with anything. The ruthless enemy has left no safe place in Gaza.
At least 107 civilians have lost their lives in the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign over the past 24 hours. 32 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes on residential buildings in the southern city of Rafah alone. Also, a house was bombed in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, leaving at least 18 people dead there. According to media reports, Israeli attacks on the vicinity of al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City also caused a number of casualties. Areas surrounding Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis were shelled as well. Regime forces have laid siege to several hospitals, preventing medical supplies from reaching them. The Israeli onslaught on Gaza that began in early October has so far claimed more than 32,300 lives and injured nearly 75,000 others. The leader of Ansar, the movement, has praised the Yemeni nation's resilience and unity in the face of the Saudi-led coalition's aggression. Abdulmalik al-Houthi said the people of Yemen have overcome the invading forces and continue to make progress. Houthi was speaking in a televised address marking the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen. He denounced the Saudi-led aggression as an unjustified and treacherous war whose goal was to destroy Yemen, occupy it, and undermine the right of its people to freedom and independence. Houthi said the aggression resulted in the death or injury of over 50,000 civilians, mostly women and children. Ansar's leader said the Saudi-led aggression was part of a larger geopolitical strategy pursued by the U.S., U.K., and Israel to reshape the region for the benefit of the Zionist regime. He rather affirmed that despite the extensive damage to Yemen's infrastructure and high civilian toll, the nation's spirit remains unbroken. Houthi pledged Yemen will further develop its indigenous military capabilities and economy. He called on certain countries to reassess their miscalculations and aggressive policies towards Yemen. And that's a wrap for now, but stay tuned. Bye for now, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Since the war began in Gaza in October, approximately 2 million Palestinians have been displaced from the north to the south. Of these, an overwhelming body of research, including its own, documented Palestinian civilians being bombed, shot at, executed, arrested, tortured, treated in a degrading manner, and forcibly disappeared by the Zionist regime military along roads, corridors, and zones declared safe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "It was after midnight when Samir Abu Shamala heard a knock on the door. Some neighbors delivered news of an imminent attack. The Zionist regime had ordered everyone in Burj al-Masri Tower to evacuate. Samir and his family hastily left the apartment they were renting in the tower. As they went down the stairs of the building, they saw many parents carrying their children. Other residents only had bags containing essential documents. Many of the children were weeping. They had been woken up from their sleep. Soon after the evacuation occurred, the Israelis fired a number of missiles toward Burj al-Masri Tower. And so one of the largest residential buildings in the southern Gaza city of Rafah was destroyed. Samir said, I put my hands on my children's eyes and ears after the first missile, but all around me the screams of women and children grew louder. I was about to start crying, but I stopped myself. Darkness had enveloped the surrounding area when the evacuation took place, but the Zionist regime's attack on the 12-story building lit up the sky in the frightening shades of red. Samir said, it was an awful sight that I will never forget. The attack has left Samir and his family homeless once again. They had previously lived in Gaza City's Arimal neighborhood, yet they had to flee it during the earlier stages of the Zionist regime's genocidal war. Arimal has been subjected to incessant bombardments by the Zionist regime. Homes, stores, and other businesses have been reduced to rubble as a result. After moving to Rafah, Samir and his family took an apartment in Burj Al Masri Tower. Renting it cost them $700 per month. With their apartment destroyed, the family sought shelter in a hospital. The hospital was so packed with displaced people that there was no room for the family. Many other public buildings, including mosques in the area, were similarly full. As the family have been unable to find any other shelter, they are now living in their car. Wasim Afana and his family were among the last people to evacuate Burj Al Masri Tower. They heard the news of the imminent attack later than other residents. Wasim said, the moment we stepped outside the tower, a missile was fired towards the building. It's a miracle we made it out alive. Wasim's children could not stop crying as they watched the tower's destruction. He tried to calm them down by reciting verses of the Quran. The family had moved to Rafah after leaving their home in Sheikh Radwan, another neighborhood of Gaza City where the Zionist regime has caused devastation. Initially, they stayed with relatives in Rafah before managing to find an apartment in the tower. It was a considerable relief for the family to have their own apartment as the relatives' home was crowded. About 50 people were taking shelter there. The tower's destruction means that the family has now gone back to their relatives' home. Wasim said, we have no choice. Ahmad Abu Hassanein and his family have returned to Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza after Burj Al Masri Tower was destroyed. They had left Nusayrat a few months ago because the Zionist regime ordered its evacuation. Heading to Rafah, they moved to a relative's apartment in Al Masri Tower. About 60 displaced people were crammed into two rooms in the apartment. Although they had no space to themselves, the family took solace in how children could play with each other. It was less stressful than Nusayrat, where the children heard explosions constantly. Following the attack on Burj Al Masri Tower, the family stayed in their car until dawn. They then decided on going back to Nusayrat. Ahmad said, it would be better to die in my own neighborhood than in a strange place. I would be better to die with my friends and family than the people who don't know me. Meanwhile, Anadolu agency reported dozens of displaced Palestinians in the city of Rafah, southern Gaza, stand in long lines for hours to obtain drinking water as the devastating Israeli regime war continues since October 7th. The Zionist regime's attacks have damaged facilities and caused a fuel shortage in Rafah on Gaza's border with Egypt. The population has soared to 1.5 million as Palestinians seek refuge. With no electricity, residents face dire conditions. Displaced Palestinians have been experiencing a water crisis that exacerbates their suffering during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Displaced Palestinian woman Omme Allah told Anadolu agency, expressing her frustration with the difficult living conditions caused by the Zionist regime's attacks, describing the suffering as beyond imagination. Allah said the water shortage in Rafah City has exacerbated the suffering of displaced Palestinians to an indescribable extent. She expressed her astonishment at the silence of the world against war crimes and genocide committed against Palestinians by the Zionist regime in the Gaza Strip, in addition to the water and food crisis. She said, "Even water, if available, is polluted and unfit for drinking and contains germs and many impurities." She added, "It is enough injustice. We do not know how to sleep, nor do we eat or drink normally. We do not know any meaning of life, and our suffering is getting worse daily." In another interview with Anadolu, Omme Magdi Salem said the suffering is no different from her previous suffering with the water shortage crisis. She said, "We are suffering from an acute water shortage." Salim highlights the struggle to obtain drinking water, waiting for hours daily in long queues just for a single container. "Water for other uses, such as bathing and washing clothes, reaches us only once every 10 days through municipal lines," she said. Salim emphasized that water scarcity leads to hygiene deficiencies, increasing diseases. She also noted the worsening humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, highlighting the lack of necessities such as food, flour, and sugar.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisu Misha Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims and forcing the men to watch it. That's, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, you know, the enemy of the people of Esther. So every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself. The very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization, just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, or fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance, because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith, and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel, because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
But that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon, and even now we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that again. Few days cleans up. Now this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guests in Los Angeles spoke about. This optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Salam, that is absolutely right, and I believe our guest from Los Angeles also agrees, and I agree as well, that the Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world, so they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much, unfortunately, compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. But we see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber really when the rubber meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They have ties to, they were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to open up the, to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed a second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran and, to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who you know, do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansarullah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will let go, will have no problem with Ansarullah. And Ansarullah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansarullah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the weakness, the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate this spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate this spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy, and then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism, and thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
answering it down some questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom and Islamic scholar, Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of fasting or sawm. According to Islamic beliefs, in the holy month of Ramadan, the Muslims are obliged to fast for 30 continuous days. This fasting and sawm during the holy month of Ramadan has so many lessons for the people. Some of the dear listeners might not be familiar with these lessons and useful points of fasting of Muslims. Can you enumerate some of them for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The best or the most important virtue and merits of fasting is this, that it purifies, it cleans us from all the wrong things, bad things, evil things, sins. Because fasting means to control yourself, you know, to control your bad desires,
yes,
to control your bad wills, you know. This is fasting. So the in the holy month of Ramadan, of course, when we practice not to drink, when we practice not to eat, it enables us to control other bad desires, other bad wishes and wills in the rest of the months and the whole year, to become able to enable ourselves to purify and to clean ourselves from all the bad things and wrong things in the whole year.
Yes.
So that's why it's a kind of practicing, you know, it's a practice that discover and unveil the hidden kind of capabilities of us, the hidden capacities of us, that we are able to very easily control ourselves. We are able to very easily improve ourselves. Just look at the holy month of Ramadan. When you cannot, when you stop eating, for example, for 30 days.
Yes.
When you stop drinking for 30 days. So eating and drinking is something that seems very much difficult to stay away from it, you know. But in holy month of Ramadan, we understand that, no, it's not that difficult. We can do that. So then when it comes to the other kind of things, other kind of controlling, other kind of self-controls, it becomes very much easy for us that, of course, we can very easily perfect ourselves,
yes,
improve ourselves.
Okay.
Look like, for example, a student, if he wants to get, for example, the high marks, if he want to be successful, he puts some limitations on himself.
Yes.
You know, or on herself. The one who observe more limitations, more,
barriers, restrictions,
then he is the more successful.
Okay.
You know, that is why fasting, the one who fasts better than the others, he's more successful, he is more prosperous, he will get more rewards, and that rewards are also for he himself and she herself, not for Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is absolutely self-sufficient.
Yes.
He is in no need to our actions, our deeds, you know.
Yes.
All things that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provided us, for ourselves, like university. University tell us that, okay, you have to observe these things, and then finally you will get the best remark, or finally you will get the best diploma certificate, you know. So this diploma, this certificate that you will get at the end of your courses and the bachelor degree,
yes,
or the master degree or the PhD, then in the whole life you will be benefited by that.
That's
it's
right.
Not for the benefit of the university, it's for the benefit of you.
Mm-hmm.
Only the university provided you with these chances,
okay,
with these opportunities.
Yes.
Here the holy month of Ramadan is like an opportunity. Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provided us with this, saying that if you observe these certain things,
yes,
you will be rewarded that things. So those rewards are for you, and this observing the certain rules are also again for you, because it purifies you, it,
yes,
cleans you. And let's say, okay, illnesses that nowadays says,
yes,
that by fasting we can control lots of kind of bad things in our body. Bodily also it's sometimes useful. Even if that's bodily benefits were not there, again, since it's a kind of practicing by,
yes,
which we purify, we clean ourselves, it would be for the benefit of us.
Okay, that's right. And thirst and hunger are two important characteristics of the fasting for Muslims. from, we can say, early morning at dawn up to sunset, they have to fast for 30 continuous days. What are the major effects of this hunger and thirst for the Muslims?
So first of all, you know that when you observe certain, let's say, limitations or limitedness on you, if you have a good intention,
yes,
you know, if you had a good objective, if you had a good purpose for these limitations, that it would be enjoyable for you. Mm-hmm. You know, you enjoy.
Yes.
You know, like the one who is, for example, who fallen.